Welcome to Aftershock, a new series of podcasts from The Spectator on life after the pandemic, with me, Isabel Hardman. In each episode, we will look at a different issue, from the NHS to schools, mental health, and how our towns are changing now more people are working remotely. I'm going to speak to experts, people on the front line, and those most affected by the issues covered. And we'll try to come up with some solutions to the damage wrought by COVID. I do hope you enjoy listening. Last year, politicians promised to protect the NHS.
The new NHS COVID-19 app that we're launching today will help people to protect themselves, to protect their loved ones, and to protect the wider community.
We can protect our NHS.
Protect the NHS.
Protect the NHS.
Protect the NHS and save lives.
But now the health service is under greater pressure than ever before. There's a backlog of treatment, with waiting lists soaring both in terms of the number of people on them, more than 5 million, and the length of time they are waiting to get the treatment they need. You see, while the NHS didn't collapse under the strain of COVID patients, thanks to the restrictions repeatedly imposed on the population, it has not come through the pandemic unscathed by any means. I'm Isabel Hardman, and in this podcast, the first in a new series looking at the challenges for Britain after the pandemic, I'll be asking whether the NHS can recover from its own version of long COVID. Long waiting lists, burnt out staff, and crumbling hospital buildings. So how big is the scale of this treatment backlog? To find out more, I spoke to Richard Murray, head of the independent health think tank, the King's Fund. Richard, what sort of state is the NHS in as it starts to emerge from this pandemic?
So the pandemic has been a really seismic shock to the service in almost anything that it does. So we saw waiting times now lifting up, but there was an enormous drop off in the number of people being treated last year and in the number of people being referred for treatment. I think what we're going to have to find out over the next months is quite how much of that damage was a short-term blow to the service that it can recover from quite quickly, and how much of it is going to leave a much longer-term problem to be dealt with.
So there's a lot of attention on the people who have been waiting for longer than a year, but is that a bit of a red herring in terms of the backlog in treatment?
It's not a red herring, but it's very dangerous just to focus on that on its own. So if you just focus purely on the people waiting over a year, you're basically saying that it's okay for everyone to wait a year. What happens to the people that, you know, our target used to be 18 weeks, not 52 weeks. So that represents an incredible increase in people's waits. And I don't think that's where we want to end up. So you want to combine something that does try and reduce those very long waits that have built up over the last year, but doesn't do so at the expense of other people.
And this is going to lead to people being sicker when they're treated, isn't it? So we're going to see worse outcomes for a lot of illnesses, surely.
It can do. I mean, the NHS has the ability to put people in as an urgent. So if it really feels that you can't wait, you wouldn't be put on a waiting list. You would go in either as an emergency or a requirement for very urgent treatment.
However, in some cases, and perhaps cancer is the obvious one,
there can be a link between how long people wait and how the disease has progressed in the meantime. You always want to intervene as early as possible on cancer. So there's a particular concern around cancer and those other areas where you really do need to be seen quite quickly. I think for other patients, it's really just that they'll remain in more pain and discomfort. They may not particularly deteriorate in that time, but you wouldn't wish to be waiting for that long if you really do need the treatment now.
And I guess another factor is that the workforce hasn't exactly had a holiday over the past year, and so it's not necessarily ready for extended theatre opening hours in an attempt to try to clear some of the surgical backlogs.
Well, you're absolutely right. And we have to remember, before COVID came along, the NHS was slowly losing grip on demand. So the waiting times were beginning to increase before COVID, had been for a number of years. So the NHS was already struggling to keep up. Now we've had a big increase in those waits. The last thing you want to do now is to try and get staff to come in on weekends to work too much overtime when many of them are so tired already. You really run the risk that they'll leave the service and be even worse off. So it needs to be a much more measured programme to get on top of waits.
Is there a recognition of that from central government?
There's certainly a recognition of it in the words that they use and a concern about the well-being of staff. I think that's certainly the case. What we need to see is whether they try to combine that well-being, that concern for well-being of staff, and yet at the same time try and get everyone to come in on weekends and work overnight and work really, really late. You'll just irritate people. It needs to be an honest conversation with staff about what they can do and how quickly they can do it.
Do you think it's possible to clear the backlog?
The NHS has cleared bigger backlogs than this. The thing was, it took time to do it. So it's very difficult just to try and get staff to work that extra overtime that you need to bring the backlog down. What you should really be doing is thinking about, well, demand goes up by 3% a year. We need that capacity there to treat those people in the longer term and not just to run like the clappers for 3 months and then suddenly find demand going up again. It needs to be a much more medium-term
plan. You say that the NHS has cleared bigger backlogs than this. When was that?
So waiting times back in the early 2000s were very long. The waiting list might have been a bit smaller, and it was measured in a very, very different way. But there were some very, very long waits in that era too that had built up through the 1990s and up until the year 2000. What the government at that point did is really set out an 8-year plan to bring down waiting time. So it went from 2000 to 2008 before the 18-week target came in. But in that era, again, waits were often, again, measured in many months, over 12 months. And so the NHS has done this before, but it does take time to do it, at least to do it in a sustainable way. There's a really strong focus on waiting times at the moment, but activity across the NHS fell, and that means that people weren't accessing care. People with mental health conditions won't have been being referred. Now, they're not caught on waiting lists in the same way that other people are. We suspect mental health has deteriorated through this time. People's routine care in general practice will have fallen off as well. People with hypertension or high blood pressure, people with cholesterol, people with diabetes. And so there's probably, we think, a hinterland of other people that have also been affected by what COVID did to the NHS that aren't showing up on waiting times.
Richard's point about workforce burnout shows that it's not just about the NHS being asked to step up and get through more and more operations. Parts of the NHS have already stepped up dramatically in the past year, to the extent that staff are struggling to keep going.
If you're working in healthcare, not only are you, you know, working in, you know, sometimes uncertain situations, you're having to adapt, you know, you're having to provide care, taking into consideration social distancing and all of the risks from the pandemic. But you're also juggling, you know, family life, the stresses and strains outside of work, people have suffered bereavements.
Sam Allen is chair of the Health and Care Women Leaders Network, which has recently produced a report about the impact of COVID on female health and care staff.
What we need to really, really be mindful of as we're progressing through that is how we're caring for our workforce, how we're retaining them, we're not losing them, as they inevitably are required to work harder, and how we attract our new workforce, Isabel. You know, people need to see the NHS as a rewarding place to work.
And the picture from frontline workers is just as bleak. Sri Kaladindi is a psychiatrist at the Maudsley NHS Trust.
So the fact that staff have been working, additionally in terms of both their NHS job and all of the extra sort of burden of care and so on at home, has left staff feeling really exhausted. And now I think there does need to be some sort of a pause and rest for staff, because coming straight back in and dealing with that huge backlog, I think will add to the pressure on staff and potentially add to the increasing of leaving from the NHS. So it's hard because obviously we want to serve the public and make sure they get what they need, and people have had huge waits for other parts of services. But equally, staff have to be able to sustain their own health in order to provide that care.
You're worried about a potential exodus of staff. Presumably, if you've got overstretched staff, you'd be worried about mistakes being made in a clinical setting as well?
Yes. So when staff are overworked, there are more mistakes. So it is, again, about how we all think, both in terms of line managers and, you know, trust leaders, but also higher up, how government think about how we're going to support our NHS staff as we're going through and coming out of this pandemic to get that rest that they need, to have the flexible working in place. And there has been some input, certainly, around the health and wellbeing of staff. But really, we are, you know, calling, the NHS Confederation and other partners are really calling to make sure that that continues for staff. And also, on top of that, there are women who've had, for example, the long-term conditions as well. And that, I think, has had an even greater impact on their both mental health and their physical health deteriorating. So how we support those vulnerable staff as well to get back to being able to work in a more sustainable manner.
And you talk about the need for more support. So how does that manifest itself? Would it be more pay? We've had the clap for carers. Do you want a holiday for heroes? Is that even possible, given it's pretty difficult to get holiday in the NHS at the best of times, let alone now?
Yeah, what would help people to get back on track is rest. Some of that will be through leave. Some of that could be through more flexible working. Continuing with the support around health and wellbeing, there have been health and wellbeing hubs, there have been sort of counselling and coaching support for NHS staff. I think that really needs to continue, but it really needs to be tailored. And there's an element of seeing what's needed, seeing what will help at a local level, as well as, you know, at the sort of top tier national level, and making sure that that investment in the staff continues.
One of the hardest things, as Julie Doughty explains, is just telling patients that they'll have to wait longer for their surgery. Julie is a breast surgeon.
Okay, so my name's Julie Doughty. I'm a consultant breast surgeon and I work in Glasgow in a hospital called Gartnavel.
And so tell me, Julie, what the lockdown was like for you and your surgical lists.
So I think at the start of lockdown, you know, it was really very scary, I think, for everyone, because at the start we didn't know exactly what we were going to be facing. And I think, you know, when you look at what's happening in India at the minute, I think there was a great fear that that could be happening to us. The NHS would be overwhelmed and we would really struggle. So at the start of lockdown, I'm a breast surgeon and breast services have never stopped. But what we did was we looked at the referrals and we tried to prioritise patients who we thought cancer was more likely. So we saw that kind of patient. The number of surgical lists we had dropped significantly. So we had to prioritise which patients we could operate on. And we did that by looking at the biology of the tumours and tried to make sure that patients with the most aggressive types of biology were operated on first. Breast cancer is really divided into two groups. About 70% of patients have cancer which contain the hormone estrogen, 30% don't. So in the patients whose cancer had estrogen in it, we started them on a tablet to lower the estrogen, which is what we do quite often prior to COVID. And we concentrated on making sure the patients who that wasn't an option for were operated on.
And so now, as we come out of lockdown and as restrictions ease, what are things looking like for you now?
So for breast surgery throughout the UK, we have managed to keep going throughout. And to put it into perspective, in breast surgery, we receive 600,000 new patient referrals per year for breast symptoms. So that is about 30% greater than any other surgical specialty. And we normally manage to see 95% of them within 2 weeks. So clearly that's a huge logistic problem, because obviously in clinics we have to social distance, we can't have the same number of patients. So there are huge pressures on the service to get patients seen. Many units run clinics now in the evening, at weekends, to deal with that. But how long that can carry on for I think is debatable because, you know, people are really tired and exhausted. So that's one aspect of it. I don't think throughout the UK we have huge numbers of patients actually waiting for breast cancer surgery. Most patients we have managed to treat. I think the big patient group that we have a backlog for are firstly patients who at the start of the pandemic, there was no other surgical option for these women other than mastectomy. And the NICE guidance is that all women should be offered immediate reconstruction. And normally about 27% of women who have a mastectomy in the UK have an immediate breast reconstruction. So unfortunately, these women could not have immediate breast reconstruction at this point. And the reasons were that firstly, we wanted to do the simplest procedure, as you know, we didn't want people to be in hospital recovering from major surgery. And secondly, we didn't have theatre capacity. So, you know, these women in a difficult time were just incredibly brave. But they are now all waiting for delayed breast reconstruction. And at the minute, we don't have a plan going forward as to how to deal with these women. So, you know, for me, for patients who have breast cancer, we try and treat them. We try and then, you know, get them to live a life, to move forward. And I think it must be incredibly difficult to try and move forward if you are awaiting a breast reconstruction.
You and your colleagues must be absolutely exhausted at the moment, not just physically, but emotionally, by the toll of the past year in terms of seeing patients not getting what you'd like to give them.
So I think we are all tired. I think one of the things about COVID, though, is it's really strengthened us working as teams, and we've all worked together to try and utilise space, whether it's in been in the independent sector, where it's been in surgical hubs. We have all worked together. But, you know, no matter how tiring it's been for us, you know, patients have been so brave during this. You know, they haven't complained. They have got on with it. So I think that's really what keeps us going, to be truthful.
And finally, what would you like to see from the NHS, from the government, that would make things easier for you?
So I understand that in the NHS, we have millions of people waiting for operations. I mean, I know that my brother is waiting for a cataract operation, so I know exactly what it's like. And there are, you know, everyone is competing for surgical space, for priority. With us, you know, for these patients awaiting breast reconstruction, for us, I really would like a plan for these women, because it's this open-endedness of not being able to tell them what is going to happen. For me, I would really like a plan to be able to deal with this. Now, how we do that, whether we have surgical hubs, whether that's in designated green hospitals, or whether we continue to use the independent sector, I know the government has committed money to doing this. I think that's one thing. However, you know, it's not just, you don't just need surgeons to carry out operations. You need nurses, you need anaesthetists. And I think we are struggling, you know, with staff. My husband is an anaesthetist. He is 64 and, you know, was about to retire. He's come back. He's been working, you know, 3-4 days a week. You know, people can't carry on and do that forever. So, you know, I think we have got a problem. It isn't just finding the capacity, it's finding the staff to do this surgery as well, I think is important. Obviously, during the pandemic, we could not see as many patients as we normally do. But I think looking at the data coming out, so when patients present with breast cancer, 60% are diagnosed by coming to the clinic, 30% through breast screening. And we know breast screening was suspended. But I think the data coming out shows that in the first part of 2020, the number of cancers diagnosed through the symptomatic clinic was the same as the previous year. So I think that is very encouraging going forward. Clearly, the pandemic is going to have had an impact, but hopefully we will have minimised the impact of that on breast cancer outcome. But we need long-term data to really see and find out if that is the case.
So what can the governments in the UK do to help the NHS in its four nations deal with this backlog, give its staff the break and support that they need after the pandemic, and still meet the expectations of the public? I brought together a panel of experts in the field, a brains trust if you like, to discuss the solutions. Jeremy Hunt was the longest serving Health Secretary and is now the chair of the Commons Health Select Committee, which recently published a report on burnout in the NHS. Chris Hobson is Chief Executive of NHS Providers, which represents NHS Trusts, and Rob Findlay is an expert on waiting lists. I asked Jeremy Hunt first what he thought could be done. So firstly, Jeremy Hunt, is it actually possible for the NHS to deal with this backlog in treatment that we're seeing? Or is it always going to be the case that it's going to be less of a fast service, less quality than it was before the pandemic?
It definitely can be dealt with. It will need a very sustained political focus and operational focus. And we need to make sure that we don't avoid the elephant traps that I've seen so many times in the last decade, where you pour money into a project without actually thinking about the fundamental capacity of the system. How many doctors, how many nurses, both in the independent sector and in the NHS. Because if you don't think about capacity and you just throw money at the problem, you just bid up the salaries of the doctors and nurses you have in the system, end up with an even higher bill for locum doctors and agency nurses. So it needs much better quality workforce planning if you're going to do this than, if I can put it this way, we have been famous for over the years.
Chris Hobson, is that your experience, Jeremy's point on workforce and the risks actually of just bringing locums in and lining their bank accounts rather than doing something in a cost-effective way?
Well, I think we have a moral responsibility to treat this on the basis that we can do it and be optimistic about doing it because of the patients who need the treatment. And if you look at what the NHS achieved over the last 12, 15 months, 30,000 extra beds for coronavirus patients, the world-beating pace at which we've rolled out the vaccination campaign, the degree to which we've managed to flex our critical care capacity with great dexterity to avoid what's currently happening in Brazil and India, it shows we can do some extraordinary things. But I suppose the argument would be really in the same vein as Jeremy, is that we're going to have to really transform the way that we do this. The conventional approach would be to do yet another waiting list initiative, lots of overtime and kind of lots of use of the private sector. Our view is, on the basis of the work that our trusts have done over the last month looking at this, is that's not going to be enough. We're going to absolutely have to transform the way that we do things. So there is a deal here, it feels to me. There's a team plan that we need. The NHS element of the team plan has been, we've got to make that transformation and really focus on this. But the government end of the plan is that transformation is going to have to be funded so that we can, you know, enable that change. And that's where I think the spending review at the end of the year really hoves into view.
Let's talk in a little bit more detail, Chris, about what you mean when you say transformation. Are we talking about the sort of the reforms that the Blair government brought in to tackle its waiting list, waiting time problems that ended up with foundation hospitals? Are we talking about that sort of restructuring? I mean, there is health legislation in the offing in the next few months, isn't there? Would that be the vehicle for it?
No, I don't think we are. It's less that. I think it's more a combination of things. Like, we definitely will need to kind of grow capacity. So I was talking to a chief exec yesterday who wants to crane in two temporary operating theatres at a cost of 15 million, which would make a huge, huge difference. We also need to work much more effectively and collaboratively as individual organisations. So a last May bank holiday weekend, the trust in Bath managed to work with 70 patients who they couldn't treat in Bath to basically transfer them across to Salisbury. And as a result, 70 children who'd been waiting a very long time got their surgery done by working with the patients. We're going to also need to do things like, you know, if you look at ophthalmology, which is one of the biggest, longest waiting lists, we know that Moorfields have really kind of pioneered some very interesting technology-led approaches to cataract operations. We need those adopted more widely. We also, by the way, need to tackle some of the real kind of pinch points here, like we simply don't have enough diagnostic capacity. So we're going to need to have more MRI and CT scanners. So there's a whole bunch of things, but then it's less about organisational structural reform. It's much more about how do you actually change the care pathways and how you provide the care to really speed up. Because if we don't, and we've said this publicly, some of the organisations who've got the longest waiting lists are saying to us that if we carry on the current trajectory, we're talking about backlogs that would take 3 to 5 5 years to clear, and that is simply not good enough. We know that. That's why we need this kind of team plan of doing things differently but appropriately funded.
Well, that leads us on to Rob. You are a waiting list expert. Just tell us a little bit about some of the backlogs that some trusts are having to deal with and how long you think they are going to take to clear.
Well, I think the first thing to bear in mind is that the NHS was not keeping up with demand for elective care even before COVID. So waiting lists were getting bigger and waiting times were getting bigger as well. And then during COVID, the referrals dried up, but activity dried up as well because the NHS was unable to treat as many patients because of the inevitable restrictions that COVID put in place. Now, the activity that's been lost during COVID is lost forever. We have to catch up on that. But many of the patients who have very considerately avoided the NHS during the pandemic are expected to come back at some point, probably a large number this year, maybe some a bit further ahead. And until the NHS can get back to a position where activity, so that's patients being seen and treated, can get ahead of demand, there will be no elective recovery at all. Activity has to get ahead of demand before there's any recovery. And then the extent to which you get ahead of demand determines how fast that recovery will be. Now, looking at the likely scale of the backlog, and we don't know how many patients are going to come back, but we're looking at something like a 10 to 20% increase in activity above pre-COVID levels for most of the decade to get back well inside 18 weeks. And that's a very significant amount. And I agree with what Jeremy and Chris have said about NHS capacity. I think there's a key distinction to be made here, which is between what you need to do to keep up with demand, which really is something that the NHS should absolutely be tooled up to do, to keep on top of the demand that's coming to the NHS all the time. And then activity that is genuinely a one-off to clear the current backlog and get back to where we want to be, where there could be a role for extra NHS capacity or the independent sector. But as Jeremy and Chris suggest, you know, this tends to be very expensive. I mean, there is another way, given the timescales we're looking at, which would be to build up NHS core capacity, get it well ahead of demand, chip away at this backlog over the years, and then you'll be in a better position for the future because you'll be able to keep up with demand into the future and stop this from slipping back again.
Jeremy Hunt, either way, it sounds like the Treasury is going to have to shell out a hell of a lot more money in order to get on top of this. Is that correct?
It is. And I completely agree with Chris that we have a moral imperative to get on top of this backlog. I'm a great believer in governments not undoing the good things their predecessors have done, whatever the political rhetoric in election campaigns. And bringing down waiting times was an achievement of the Blair-Brown years, which I think everyone recognises is a good step forward, and we don't want to go back on that. I hope the focus on safety and quality in the decade that followed that with mid-staffs and all the agony of that is something that likewise we continue to build on. But I think it's really important that we do this in a strategic way. And picking up on what Rob says, we have got to recognise that with an ageing population, we are going to need a sustained increase in NHS capacity. Last year globally was the first year in human history where there were more over 65s than under 5s across the planet. And the reality of an ageing population means that we're going to need much more capacity for surgery, for coping with cancers, other conditions like dementia and so on. And so what we need to do is to map the surge we're going to need in the medium term to get rid of the backlog with a longer term increase in capacity. And that's why I strongly support overhauling the way we plan our workforce demand for the future. I think we need a body to act a bit like the OBR acts for the Treasury as a kind of independent arbiter that keeps the government honest and is very clear and objective about how many doctors and nurses in every specialty we're going to need in the next 5, 10, 15 and 20 years. I'd be happy if Health Education England did that, providing it was objectively done and independently done. But we do need something like that. And we need it for morale reasons as well, because we need to give confidence to doctors, nurses on the front line that the pressures that they see every day which they know can't be resolved immediately. They know it takes 7 years to train a doctor, but that there is a plan in place to deal with those shortages over time.
Do you think your political colleagues, those in government, Jeremy Hunt, see this as being an issue? Do you think they understand the scale of what's needed?
I think they understand the political salience of the NHS. The Hartlepool by-election result is an example of how potent a political formula Conservatives have when we are very clearly on the side of improving public services and spreading wealth around the country, as well as our traditional Tory virtue of making the books balance and looking after the economy. So I think everyone understands that. Do we understand that the NHS is going to need a sustained increase in funding over the next decades? The social care system, likewise, a sustained increase in funding. I don't think we've quite appreciated that in a system where these structures, the social care system and the NHS, are largely funded through taxpayers, that is going to maintain the level of GDP that we spend through the government at higher levels than in countries like the United States, where the money is paid for out of people's own pockets. And I think that is something probably people inside the Conservative Party have still got to come to terms with.
Chris Hopson, is that your experience of negotiating with the Health Department and with the Treasury? You've had some pretty 11th hour decisions on COVID funding, for instance, over the past few months.
No, I think Jeremy puts it really, really well, which effectively is that we do need this debate about the underlying level of funding we're going to need to devote to our health and care system. We've been through a decade of the longest and deepest funding squeeze in NHS history. And the reality is that, you know, Jeremy did a grand job of securing an increase, but I think even he would recognise that that only takes us back to long-term trend growth, which in terms of NHS funding increases. And if you look at, you know, the pressures that we've got coming in terms of an ageing population, then that's a real issue. Can I just pick up, Isabel, on something that Rob said, which I think is really important in this context, which is we don't still know exactly what the problem is in terms of we do have these missing referrals that we were expecting to see last year that haven't come forward. Some of them are beginning to come forward. And if you really want to illustrate this really well, there's a lovely little thing that I picked up just this morning, which is I was talking to a trusted chief executive and they're going incredibly fast trying to go through, you know, the most urgent cases. But he said, at the moment, every single case that I treat, I'm getting two added to the waiting list. So as these referrals kind of, so even though we're going really pretty fast, the reality is that actually, you know, we're finding that we still don't know what the full depth of the problem is, which then I think brings us to Jeremy's really important point, which is that we've got to have a strategic plan here. And what worries me is that because the political pressure is going to grow and there will be a need for action, we're going to rush into something very, very quick and just do the usual stuff, like, for example, as we were saying earlier, overtime, use of the independent sector. And if we do something too quickly at a rush, we won't get the strategic approach that's needed, we won't get the right capacity in place, and crucially, we won't get the bold, radical, transformative plan that we need. So we need the government to hold its nerve here. And for me, the ideal time to bring all of this together under a new chief executive of the NHS is effectively in the spending review, where we can say, here's the priority we want to put on this, here's the amount of money we're going to allocate for the rest of the parliament, but here's the bold transformative plan that goes with it to change the way we provide care. And then obviously we in the NHS will need to sign up to, okay, so how quickly then can you get through the backlog? You can't do that in a couple of months' time. We need to basically take the time, really including working out actually how big the problem is.
Rob, I'll just let you respond to that from Chris.
Yes, in terms of priorities against other spending priorities, the thing I'd say is that in the long run, the NHS has to keep up with elective demand. It doesn't have a choice about it. You can't get ahead of elective demand indefinitely, or you'd run out of waiting list to treat, and you can't fall behind indefinitely either, because you'd end up with multi-year waits, and it would be politically unacceptable. So in the long run, you have to keep up with elective demand. And you can either do that with long waiting lists and long waiting times, or you can do it with short waiting lists and short waiting times. And we both know which are better. It's not just better, it's also cheaper.
Just explain to listeners who don't understand that point a little bit more, the difference between long waiting lists and short waiting lists. And it might sound like an obvious point, but which one is better in terms of priorities?
So it's better to have short waiting lists and short waiting times. And there are many reasons for this. Firstly, it's safer. Patients need to get to diagnosis and decision quickly. Nearly a quarter of all the cancers that get picked up were referred to hospital not on a cancer pathway. So their cancer is not suspected until they see a specialist and then it gets picked up. So you've got to get all patients to diagnosis and decision quickly, not just the ones that you already suspect to have cancer in urgent conditions. So that's a concrete example of why short waiting lists and short waiting times are much better. For operations, if you've got a severely painful hip and you can't work, then it's obviously you want to get your operation quickly. You don't want to be waiting months or years for that. So if the NHS just keeps up the demand and it's absolutely steady state and the rate they're coming in matches the rate that you're getting patients seen and treated, then the waiting list will remain the same size. It can remain the same size if it's very short, or it can remain the same size if it's very long. If it's very long, it's not safe, it's a bad service for patients. It's also very expensive because you've got the hospital has to administer thousands, even tens of thousands of patients who move house, their circumstances change, they get lost in the system. It's inefficient and unsafe to be administering a gigantic waiting list that we have now.
Isabel, the longer that the patient wait, the worse that their conditions get, and therefore the more serious the action that needs to be taken and the more costly it is. So that's another good reason to add to Rob's two or three as to why, you know, shorter waiting lists and shorter waiting times are more important.
There's also, Rob, a question of priorities about who to tackle first. Is it the people who have been waiting longer than a year already, or is it the people who are actually sort of in the middle? I know there's different names for these different groups, so if you could explain those as well, that would be very helpful.
So the first priority is to make the waiting list safe. And this is principally about patients with urgent clinical need. We don't know who they all are yet, which is what I said earlier about getting patients up to diagnosis. The NHS is generally pretty good at making sure that patients who are known to be urgent get in urgently. We also need to have more of a focus on those that we don't yet know are urgent. And then it's broadly speaking, first come, first served is the way that the rest of the list tends to work. The three words I would use to describe good waiting list management are safe, fair and efficient.
I just say one final point. If we are going to have some major NHS legislation, it's not always that happens. This is a really good opportunity to sort out the long-term issues around NHS workforce. And I think if we address the long-term issues, we'll be in a much better position to deal with the short-term ones as well.
Just on workforce, Jeremy Hunt, you as Health Secretary didn't have as much of an opportunity as some would have liked to have solved those workforce shortages. What blocked that for you?
Well, actually, I was really proud. I set up 5 new medical schools. I increased doctor and nurse and midwife training places by a quarter. I think it's the biggest single increase that there's ever been. But you know, the truth is these things take time. And, you know, it's not just taking 7 years to train a doctor, but by the time you make a decision, you persuade a medical school to offer the extra places, it's probably 9 or 10 years before you actually see any new doctors arriving in the system. And that's why I think you need a discipline on ministers and on the system to think long term, because there's always a temptation to cut costs in the short term by not training enough doctors. But a system like the NHS, one of the world's best health systems, needs to be training the numbers of doctors and nurses that it actually intends to use. That's not to say we don't have really important international collaboration and exchanges, but I actually think there's something ethically very dubious about importing a lot of doctors from developing countries where they are desperately needed.
Isabel, given that you operate very successfully at the where kind of politics meets the NHS, there's one important point about prioritisation here where politics meets the NHS, which is at the moment all the political and media focus is on the 52-week waiters, people who've been waiting for longer than 52 weeks, and it's gone from a very small number of thousands, about 1,000, I think 2,000 before COVID, up to I think 400,000 was the last kind of figure that we saw. And that's where all the pressure is coming. But if you talk to frontline clinicians, what they say are the people who worry the most are the people who could suffer permanent disability or an inability to go back to work and who may well be waiting 30, 35, 40 weeks. So we again require our politicians to be disciplined here and not just jump straight for the bit that is atop of the kind of political and media priority list, which is the 52-week plus waiters. And they've got to be allow the NHS to really focus where it matters most in terms of clinical need, which is on those people who may well be awaiting less than 52 weeks. And that is going to be a difficult argument to win, given the focus that will be on the 52-week plus waiters. But it's absolutely vital that occurs.
I would agree with that 100%, yes. The SAFE approach that I outlined focuses on getting patients to diagnosis and decision quickly. And this is the opposite of the current emphasis, which is on the very, very longest waiters in referral to treatment terms, who are much more likely to already have a diagnosis and a decision than those who've waited less time. In terms of doing this and the priority and the difficulty of doing this, what I'd say is we know that we can do it because we've done it before. 8 years ago, referral to treatment waiting times were less than 16 weeks. It was absolutely fantastic, and it slid away slowly since then because the NHS just wasn't able to quite keep up with demand. But we know we can do it. It's already in the baseline. We can do it again.
Ministers insist that they backed the NHS all the way last year and are continuing to do everything they can to support the health service as it comes out of the pandemic. But it's clear that this support is going to need to continue for years on end. As we'll hear in the next few episodes of this series, the health service isn't the only part of the system that needs more money post-COVID. And it's not the only public service that's politically salient either. Tough decisions about spending are just one part of this. It's always tempting for politicians to focus merely on the short term. But as my guests have made clear, one of the reasons the service is struggling so much now is that there has been a long-term refusal from the Treasury to allow proper workforce planning. Will that change now? Or will ministers lose focus as other issues start to clamour for attention too? If they wait for the next election to start dealing with this, it will be too late. For them politically, but even more importantly, for the patients who've been left waiting. That was the latest in the Aftershock series of podcasts looking at life after the pandemic. I'm Isabel Hardman. Thank you for listening.